There aren't many people in the world who write excellent books that also get turned into excellent films. Among them is this guy.
My name's Michael Lewis, and I just think of myself as a writer.
What makes Michael Lewis's rare feat even rarer is that his books wouldn't seem at all conducive to the Hollywood treatment. Books like Moneyball,
which was about the way the Oakland A's managed to function on a shoestring budget in Major League Baseball. And the book was, in my mind, really about the way the market for baseball players misvalued those players. The then experts in baseball, scouts, would make big mistakes in deciding who was a good player and who wasn't a good player. And the A's were exploiting this by using statistical analysis.
The problem we're trying to solve is that there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap, and then there's us.
Or an even more unlikely book to be turned into a film, The Big Short, Lewis's book about how a housing bubble turned into a financial disaster.
With something called a credit default swap, it's like insurance on the bond, and if it goes bust, you can make 10 to 1, even 20 to 1 return.
I was astonished that anybody bothered to make Moneyball, much less The Big Short. And so my experience with the movie business is peculiar, because what seems to happen is I write books that are ever harder to turn into movies, and they work ever harder to make them into movies.
His latest book may pose the biggest challenge yet. It is called The Undoing Project, and it's about a pair of academics in a room alone for a few decades writing papers. They're a pair of Israeli psychologists named Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman.
And one of their great discoveries is that people don't make clean, clear choices between things. They make choices between descriptions of things.
No car chases, no doomsday scenarios, but it may still be movie material. For what Kahneman and Tversky did was nothing less than redefine how we humans think. Is that dramatic enough for you?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, as a fellow writer, I want to ask you this. Reading your work is so pleasurable and easy, and I don't mean that at all as a pejorative. I love the way you use language and words to talk about ideas. It's an incredibly rare ability. But because it's so pleasurable and easy to read, one might assume that the writing of these books is easy and perhaps pleasurable. Is it? Are you, Michael, any less tortured than the average writer?
Yes. It is pleasurable and easy. I hate to ruin your punchline, but it actually, what's hard for me is figuring out in the beginning what I want to say. I spend a lot of time gathering material and organizing the material before I sit down to write. I'd say 3/4 of the time is that. When the actual writing starts, it's, for me, fun. It's just fun. I mean, it's fun and hard, but if it's hard in a fun way. And people who have, like my wife, who has walked in on me while I'm writing, I write with headphones on that just plays on a loop, the same playlist that I've built for whatever book I'm writing. And I cease to hear anything in the world outside what I'm doing. And apparently, I'm sitting there laughing the whole time. I think basically what I'm doing is laughing at my own jokes. But I wasn't even aware of that. But people, my kids and my wife say that you're sitting there at the desk laughing all the time.
What's on your playlist? What kind of stuff? Is it pop songs with lyrics, or does it have to be more kind of background stuff?
It's pop songs with lyrics, but I cease to hear it. So the playlist for The Undoing Project include 2 versions of Jesse Girl, the Rick Springfield song. It's a Meghan Trainor. You know, Adele's new album, a Cat Stevens song. It's a Jim Croce song. And they just, you know, it's kind of a random assortment of stuff. What it all has in common is it kind of gets me up. And after I've listened to it a few times while writing, I have this Pavlovian response to it. So if you played like a Meghan Trainor song right now,
you just start typing.
I look for a keyboard. That's exactly right. So it actually kind of just, it's a very odd kind of conditioning mechanism for me.
The Undoing Project began to germinate more than a decade ago. Lewis had just published Moneyball.
The heart of the story was that markets can really pretty dramatically misvalue and misjudge people. And if a baseball player could be misjudged, who couldn't be, kind of thing. I thought it had a kind of universal message to it. What I didn't do is ask why baseball scouts were misvaluing baseball players. And I didn't really even notice that I hadn't done that.
Lewis didn't notice that until he read a review of Moneyball, published in The New Republic, by the economist Richard Thaler and the legal scholar Cass Sunstein.
And they said, very sweetly, that this is a good story Michael Lewis has written, but he doesn't seem to realize that these two guys named Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, psychologists, have explored the biases in the human mind that lead people to make these sorts of misjudgments. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
The fact that someone like Michael Lewis hadn't even heard of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky tells you something about how obscure most academic research is. It also tells you something about Lewis.
I tend to have tunnel vision when I'm working on something. And when Danny Kahneman got the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002, I was in an Oakland A's dugout. And so I just wasn't paying attention.
And it's not like Kahneman and Tversky are exactly famous today outside of some rather specific circles. But those circles have been expanding. And even if you don't know Kahneman and Tversky by name, you are living through a revolution that their research has made possible. A revolution as basic and important as understanding how people make decisions. Small decisions, like what to eat for lunch, and big ones, like whether to start a war. This revolution has many components and several names, the most prominent being behavioral economics, which is an interesting name for a couple of reasons. Number one, shouldn't all economics be behavioral? And number two, a lot of what people talk about when they talk about behavioral economics isn't really economics at all, which makes sense since Kahneman and Tversky were psychologists and not economists. But economists, as Freakonomics Radio listeners know, can be a grabby breed. So they put their name on it, behavioral economics. Anyway, what is it? Loosely defined, it's a way of blending empiricism and common sense to understand how people behave. It marries the economist's belief that people respond to incentives with the psychologist's understanding that people often don't respond to incentives as rationally as economic theory might predict. It all starts with recognizing the gap between how we think we make decisions and how we actually make them. The foundation of this field, along with much of its nomenclature, came from the minds of just two men, Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman. They had a particularly intense and intimate intellectual partnership.
Danny is a fertile source of ideas. So he's really generative. And it's not that Amos isn't capable of being generative, but Danny is off the charts generative. He's almost the poetic or novelistic mind in the room. And Amos is the diamond cutter. Amos is a pure analytical mind who sees levels of abstraction in Danny's ideas and generalizes them and formalizes them so that they can be tested and expressed in a way that is academically respectable. But I think what they actually are doing is they're laughing at stupid things people do. Amos was asked once by somebody, says, oh, does the work you and Danny do have any bearing on artificial intelligence? And Amos said, I'm much more interested in natural stupidity than I am in artificial intelligence. It wasn't a mocking spirit in which they operated. They were laughing also at themselves, at the sort of things that they did that struck them as irrational. And they were mining that for gold. They have a rattle bag of ideas that they end up trying to classify.
Ideas that all revolved around a central realization that when most of us make decisions, we essentially ignore the laws of probability and even logic, that we rely instead on primitive rules of thumb and shortcuts, or heuristics in the language of academia, that are prone to error. One such heuristic that Kahneman and Tversky explored is known as anchoring.
Anchoring is the idea that your mind can be swayed by totally irrelevant information when you're making a judgment. And they tested it by creating a Wheel of Fortune that had numbers 1 to 100 on it. You, the subject, the lab rat, would spin the wheel of fortune and some number would come up, 20 or 47. And then they asked you to estimate what percentage of the countries in the United Nations came from Africa. And what they showed is people who spun a higher number on the wheel of fortune placed a higher estimate there, and the people who spun a lower number on the wheel of fortune guessed lower. And they were anchored by just this number that had been mentioned before. The idea that you could have that kind of effect on a totally irrelevant judgment by just putting a number in front of it, I think it's totally original. Although every used car salesman sort of understands,
exactly.
Right? Or Donald Trump understands. You name some huge number, and that becomes what you're kind of centering your judgment around. But what they showed is the number can have nothing whatsoever to do with the judgment you're making and still affect the judgment.
Another mental shortcut Kahneman and Tversky examined is called the availability heuristic.
It's a fancy name for just memory, like what comes to mind easily and how that warps your judgment. For example, you're driving down the highway and you're going 75 miles an hour like everybody else. You're kind of assuming it's safe because nothing is alerting you to the probability of an accident. And then you see a horrible accident and everybody slows down to 50 because all of a sudden, probability of accident is more available. It's in your mind. So what comes easily to mind leads to all kinds of biases that people have named, the vividness bias. People think that a baseball player is a better baseball player than he is if his talents are very vivid. If he's really, really fast or has a lot of power, he's more likely to be overvalued than if he has subtle abilities like plate discipline, because those aren't vivid. Recency bias is a consequence of the availability heuristic. It's whatever happened most recently is judged to be more probable or more likely. Hurricane hits New Orleans, wipes it out. Everybody thinks hurricanes are more likely to hit New Orleans than they really are, and so forth.
A lot of Kahneman and Tversky's research looked at how people think about risk and how we typically give adverse events a lot more weight than positive events. That was the thrust of their most influential paper, published in 1979. It was called Prospect Theory, an analysis of decision under risk. It argued that the standard economic model for decision making didn't fully account for how real people make real decisions, especially if there's the possibility of a very bad outcome. It made sense that Kahneman and Tversky thought about this differently than economists. They were, after all, psychologists, but also they'd both seen some bad outcomes themselves. As a child, Kahneman survived the Holocaust, just barely, in France. Tversky was a paratrooper and an infantry commander in the Israeli army and saw his share of death and disaster. Their own experiences with risk and adverse events informed what they thought about as scholars. They were both obsessed with how people process information, with how cognitive shortcuts get in the way of long-term logic, and especially with how we try in our minds to explain or even undo our worst experiences. The Undoing Project, the title of Michael Lewis's book, was also the name of the last project that Tversky and Kahneman worked on together.
And the nature of the project was they were going to explore the rules of the human imagination. They'd come to the conclusion that the imagination wasn't just this free-flowing thing, that it actually had obeyed certain rules, and the way they thought they were going to study it was by studying the way people undid tragedies and try to create alternative scenarios. Because what these guys are engaged in doing is undoing a false view of human nature and the way the mind works. And that had infiltrated the social sciences and we're just kind of in the air we breathed.
As useful as it is, obviously, to identify all these heuristics we use and all the errors they lead to and honestly all the kind of loss that it leads to, how prescriptive were Kahneman and Tversky?
You know, they were very diffident about how their work was going to be used. So I think they thought that people were never going to be very good at correcting for their own illusions. But I think they also thought that they might be good at correcting for other people's illusions, that it was easier to spot the mistakes and inefficiencies and irrationalities in other people's thinking and decision-making and judgment than it was your own. That and also the whole Moneyball thing, that you use data as an antidote to the warping that naturally goes on when you're making intuitive judgments.
Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman met in the late 1960s. They were both teaching psychology at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Aside from that fact, they didn't have much in common. Tversky was outgoing and headstrong and popular. Kahneman was brooding and, despite his brilliance, riddled with insecurities. They also looked at psychology very differently.
Amos had a kind of sterility to his academic interests. He was a mathematical psychologist. And if you want to put yourself to sleep at night, grab a mathematical psychological textbook. It doesn't really seem to have much to do with psychology. And Amos was happily assuming the assumptions of economics and mathematical psychology, which were that people were basically rational. People, when they were making judgments and decisions, were basically, you know, good intuitive statisticians and making judgments as if they were good at them.
Kahneman wasn't mathy at all. Intuitive, yes, and thoughtful, maybe to a fault. All he could think about was thinking. And he thought that the standard assumptions of mainstream economics and psychology were ridiculous. And he said so to Amos Tversky's face when Kahneman invited Tversky to speak to a graduate seminar that Kahneman was teaching. Tversky, with his usual brio, began to extol the notion that most people are pretty good at making decisions based on a rational assessment of the available information.
And Danny is the first one to really challenge him on this, saying, I'm not. I make mistake after mistake after mistake, and I'm smarter than most of the people I know. This is nonsense that I can show to you that people make systematic mistakes when they're faced with decisions and judgments. And this intrigued Amos, and very quickly, they are in a room together with the door shut and don't want to see anybody else. And a collaboration begins. And the collaboration is all about the exploration of how the human mind actually works.
This collaboration was surprising to just about everyone at Hebrew University.
They were regarded as two big dogs on campus, yet they were also regarded as polar opposites. No one who knew them both could imagine them spending 5 minutes together. Kahneman was difficult, neurotic, seemingly perpetually unhappy, full of doubt, you know, tortured. He was very fertile, had lots of ideas, but the minute he had the ideas, he thought they were crap, and he would walk away from his own ideas very quickly. What he says now is he had a peculiar talent for changing his mind. He liked changing his mind. That's a nice spin on a kind of—
Do you believe it?
I think it's much more complicated than that. I think that he doesn't know what stability feels like. He was a child of the Holocaust. He spent, you know, ages 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 being chased through southern France by Nazis and hiding in chicken coops and barns. He watched his father die because he couldn't seek medical treatment for fear of being caught by the Germans. And he himself has, as one of his central qualities, a kind of evasiveness. People found him hard to know, but incredibly talented. And when he got up in front of a class and talked, he was mesmerizing. So mesmerizing, as one of the students said, that after he'd had Danny's class, he kind of found other professors not that interesting. And he complained to one of the administrators at Hebrew University. He says, you can't do this. He said, you can't compare other teachers to Kahneman. There's Kahneman, and then there's everybody else. Amos was untroubled, happy, simple, very clear in his head. You know, you describe his childhood. It's not the childhood of an intellectual. It's a childhood of a kind of happy kid who's pressed into a military service and through kind of status needs becomes a Spartan warrior, like a lot of these first-generation Israelis were at that time. And he almost certainly killed people. He almost certainly had people trying to kill him. He was a decorated war hero, among other things. He saved other soldiers' lives and risked his own. And at the end of his life, he still had shrapnel in his body. And was widely admired by everybody who knew him. And he was, from a very early age, identified by other people more than by himself as intellectually spectacular. The psychologist Richard Nisbet, after he got to know Amos, designed a one-line intelligence test which gets repeated over and over. And it's the longer it takes you to figure out that Amos Tversky is smarter than you, the stupider you are.
Amos Tversky was smart enough to realize that Danny Kahneman, for all his insecurities, would be a priceless intellectual partner.
Central to the dynamic was Amos giving Danny the confidence to be himself. That Danny did not have confidence to be himself, and he didn't realize how precious and valuable he was.
And thus began one of the most productive intellectual partnerships in modern history. Before long, both men moved to the States. They wrote paper after paper after paper, many of them fiercely original and, at first glance, a bit weird. For academia is a realm in which originality is praised but rarely pursued. Tversky and Kahneman tore apart and then reconstructed the models that social scientists use to make sense of human behavior. Talk to me for just a minute about the degree to which the rest of the world is using moves from, nudges from, whatever we want to call them, that are derived from the work of Kahneman Tversky, and how successful you think they're being.
It's a messy story, but it is incredible to me how many different spheres of human existence these guys' work has touched and influenced. So it's not just economics. You know, medicine, it's now a standard part of medical training for doctors to be introduced to Kahneman Tversky's work, or at least their ideas, because they're going to be rendering intuitive judgments about patients, and they need to be aware of how they might be fallible. In government, I think the big influence that Amos and Danny have had is in an awareness of the importance of choice architecture, that the environment in which people make the decision has a huge effect on the decision. And if you want government workers to save more money, you design the pension plans so that they have to opt out of them rather than opt into them. And all of a sudden, you double or triple the savings rates. If you want school lunches to be healthy, you create the default option as a healthy option and force the kids to trade it in for a less healthy option if they want it. There are units in the U.S. government, in the British government, in the Australian government, the German government's interested in it, the Scandinavian governments. They're calling them nudge units after Dick Thaler and Cass Sunstein's work. But his job is really to create environments that will lead people to make choices that are good for them. And that really comes out of Danny and Amos's work. I mean, one of their great discoveries is that people don't make clean, clear decisions between things or choices between things. They make choices between descriptions of things. So how things are described have a huge effect on the way people choose. And governments are often charged with creating these decision-making environments.
So these two guys, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, had an incredibly fruitful, original intellectual partnership that was also a very rocky relationship at times. Danny felt that Amos was getting a lot of credit for their work. Danny could be resentful and insecure. And as you write the story, 3 days before Amos Tversky was diagnosed with melanoma, they'd effectively ended their friendship. Kahneman called it a divorce. Amos died. Danny later won a Nobel Prize in economics, and Amos being dead was not eligible to receive that. So Danny wins the Nobel for work that had been done largely with Amos. So talk for a minute about Danny's feelings about the award and all the recognition and opportunity it brought to him with his partner gone.
One of the most lovable things about Danny Kahneman is, as much as he tortures other people with his doubt, he tortures himself even more. And when Amos had died, he was left with a sense, Danny, that the world found their work extremely important, but thought he didn't have that much to do with it. And he had an invitation from the Nobel Prize Committee to come and give a talk in 2001 in Stockholm, which he thought of as an audition for the Nobel Prize. And he thought the question wasn't, is the work worthy? The question is, am I worthy? And he, you know, some part of him, I think, thought maybe he wasn't. Some part of him always wondered how important he was, where Amos had never had any doubts about Danny's importance. I mean, I think Amos actually thought Danny was more important than Amos to the whole thing. And so the prize has, prizes usually have a kind of temporary effect. I think Danny and Amos's own work would predict that people's expectation of happiness from a Nobel Prize would exceed the happiness in the moment, which would probably exceed the happiness of the memory of it.
Well, unless the prize leads to opportunity and continuing recognition, which it really did in this case, right?
In this case, and it did, and it, people who know Danny told me going in that one of the problems you're going to have writing this book is the person who we know post-Nobel Prize is entirely different from the person who got the Nobel Prize, and that he is much less gloomy, much less consumed with doubts, that there's kind of like a sense in Danny that everything might kind of work out, which he never had before. And it puts him in a position in relation to the rest of the world that he's most comfortable with. He's the descendant of famous rabbis. And he once said that when someone asked him if he could imagine an alternative career for himself, he said, I could only have been two things, a professor or a rabbi. He likes to be in the position of being the wise man, and he naturally is the wise man. And when you have a Nobel Prize in not even your field, I mean, he doesn't even know that much economics, and they gave him the Nobel Prize in economics because of the influence he had on economics. You are treated wherever you go as the wise man, and he plays the role beautifully.
Well, and he deserves it, frankly, right?
My God. I've written about a lot of people, and I've had a lot of characters in my life over the course of my career. I've never had one of such depth of interest as Danny Kahneman. Everything that comes out of his mouth is interesting. Everything he thinks is interesting. He just doesn't believe it.
For the record, it was the work of Kahneman and Tversky that first got me interested in economics and which led to Freakonomics. Before them, economics seemed too methodical, too bloodless. So I'm grateful to Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky for shining their light into the human brain. And I'm thankful to Michael Lewis for shining his light on them. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how human behavior is influenced not just by internal shortcomings, but by external pressures.
She says, wait a minute. She says, how could you see what I see and not see it as dehumanization? I thought I knew who you were. I don't know who you are. I don't know who this person is. And I'm not sure I want to continue my relationship with you if this is the real you.
That's next on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Sometimes you see a piece of theater and it completely scrambles your brain.
I remember I was at one of the first performances of Hair.
That's Philip Zimbardo, the renowned psychologist. Seeing Hair scrambled his brain because
the performers start walking on the seats over your head and walking down the aisles. And that, I had never experienced that before. And it was really, you know, troubling, exhilarating, confusing. And because, again, Hair was going to confuse you. They're going to, you know, sing songs about masturbation and black girls having sex with white guys and white guys having sex with, you know. So essentially, before the play began, what they did is set up to say, this is going to shock you. This is going to be off your usual radar. So don't come expecting, you know, traditional theater. This is something new. And I still remember that. It was like 40 years ago. We
starve, look. Again, that was Philip Zimbardo. Does that name ring a bell? If you ever took Psychology 101 in college, think back to that. You remember reading about the Stanford Prison Experiment? That was Zimbardo's experiment back in 1971, in which some student volunteers played the role of prisoners and others acted as guards. Things got ugly fast.
Everybody out. This experiment has f***ed up with Zimbardo.
To this day, Philip Zimbardo likes to mess with people.
By putting people in totally new situations, that's really how we discover something about ourselves.
We'll hear more about that later, but first, let's get to the real inspiration for today's program. It is a theater piece, an immersive, interactive theater piece. It's called Sleep No More. It's been playing in New York since early 2011, and it's the creation of a British theater group called Punch Drunk. Now, Sleep No More is a mashup of Macbeth and Hitchcock and film noir, but it's even stranger than all that.
I don't even know how to describe it. It's insane. I don't know.
It is. It's crazy.
Sexual and violent.
Crazy, insane. Yeah. Dead babies involved.
passionate. I don't know.
Sleep No More is designed to throw you off balance. It begins before you even go inside. The location is called the McKittrick Hotel, but in fact, it's an old warehouse in Chelsea. The whole thing is cloaked in secrecy.
Not really sure what to expect.
We were told to know as little as possible, and so we've done almost no research as to what we're about to do.
I'm just hoping I can make it all the way through and I don't leave. I don't get too scared.
Just like little tidbits of intrigue, you know, we've heard that you get like a key to a room, apparently everyone wears a mask and you're allowed to look through drawers in the sets, and that's about all we know.
We heard that's like psychologically intense. Yeah, psychologically intense, and that seems interesting to me.
Psychologically intense. I would agree. Now, what makes it so? Let me offer two thoughts: control and context. First, control. If you are the kind of person who likes to have a lot of control over your surroundings, if you're not exactly a go-with-the-flow type of person, and yes, I am kind of describing myself here, then Sleep No More presents you with a bit of a challenge. Once you're inside, there's a mandatory coat and bag check. Everything must go, every computer, every purse. And then you're shuffled through a long, pitch black hallway. Out of the blackness, you emerge into a bar. Nice bar, the good jazz band. Place has the feel of a speakeasy, and you're thinking, hey, what year are we in here? You're offered a drink, absinthe perhaps. A fortune teller looks you over from a corner table. After a while, you're summoned into a freight elevator where you are given a mask, a beautifully creepy beaked mask. And then you are told what you may and may not do for the rest of the evening. Here's Tori Sparks. She plays Lady Macbeth.
I think it's very telling of who you are and how you interpret those first instructions that you get. You know, keep your mask on, don't talk, don't use your cell phone. Fortune favors the bold.
Yeah.
You know, and people enter in, and some people just can't handle instructions. They can't handle limitations. They want to talk, and you just told them they can't, so they will. And other people are excited by the fact that they get to be anonymous for three hours.
Okay, so you've surrendered your valuables at the door, and you're now dispatched on a three-hour adventure about which you are told next to nothing, during which you may not speak, and yet you're also told that fortune favors the bold. So yes, you have given up a bit of control. Okay, now for the context. Where are we? Where's the stage? Well, there is no stage. Or, really, the stage is everywhere. Six floors of warehouse that have been turned into an unbelievably elaborate set. There's an old hotel and a town. There are lodgings for the Macbeths and the Macduffs. There's a grand ballroom, a forest, a hospital, a cemetery. You are allowed to wander anywhere and everywhere, to open drawers and read letters, to eat candy from the glass jars in the sweets shop.
It's sort of like a choose-your-own-adventure. So you're sort of forced to, like, forge your own path around the building and find different scenes. And
you make your own journey. It's, like, very personal.
It's sexual and leading.
You think back to what you were told, that fortune favors the bold. And you learn that you have to follow the performers from room to room, even chase them. Or they might bring you with them.
A bald woman dragged me up several flights of stairs, through staircases, and to this, like, arena, and it was, like, incredible.
The context is further muddied by the fact that none of the performers actually speak. But over the course of the evening, you will see a lot.
Someone hanging themselves was pretty cool. It's like the final. I won't tell you that, sorry.
A pregnant woman and her husband having a fight and then making up.
Lots of fighting, lots of kissing.
Lots of taxidermy.
Dry humping.
Oh, my friend Austin's in it, and he gets naked and bloody. So that was pretty crazy.
It's just, it's like a nightmare.
Yeah.
And don't forget, It's very dark, and you're wearing a mask.
The mask is utterly critical, and without it, it wouldn't work. Or it'd be something very, very different.
That's Felix Barrett. He's the artistic director of Punch Drunk and co-creator of Sleep No More.
They're faceless, they're anonymous. So there's that sort of, that normal relationship between performer and audience is completely ground down. The first time I tried it, a middle-aged lady came and apologized to me afterwards and said, "I'm so sorry, I put the mask on and I found myself being very rude. I was getting too close to the performers. I even touched one at one point. I'm so sorry."
And you must have said, "Thank you."
And I was like, "Thank you," because I didn't even realize how powerful it was, but she felt compelled to do it because the mask had given her that freedom. And as soon as it came off, she remembered who she was and where she was.
One night, Tori Sparks, who plays Lady Macbeth, was dancing inside a sort of glass box.
I had a woman, I was performing a solo in the box, mm-hmm. and like a crowd filled watching this thing, and for whatever reason, this woman decided she was going to throw objects at the glass.
Ooh.
And she found anything, and there's not much in this room you can pick up and throw, but she found it all. She found, she went in our drawer, picked up the lipstick, the fur, anything, the wet t-shirts, and just started chucking it as hard as she could at the glass. And fortunately, I was behind glass, so I just kept going with what I was doing.
Don't you really want to know what's going on in that person's mind then? Or do you just, well, I guess in the moment, you're just trying to survive the scene.
I was in shock, just like, you're really making that choice right now. Why would you even think that that's what needs to be done right now? And am I making you mad, or are you trying to mess with me? What's going on? So I tried to stay in character, and the steward that's in this room, of course, went to try and stop her, and she was like, "Oh, I didn't know. I just was completely clueless."
Fortune favors the bold.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my
but
gosh.
But meanwhile, me and all these other spectators were just like, "Huh?"
Every detail of Sleep No More, the music, the mask, the choreography, has been carefully designed to crush your expectations that going to the theater means just sitting in a square room and watching people on a stage speak their lines. Here's Felix Barrett again.
It's completely safe. It just feels we
but almost fictionalize.
We dimmed it back. We fictionalize a state of tension that feels slightly unsettling and threatening when actually it's not.
Before Sleep No More came to New York, it played in Boston, in an old school building.
When we did Boston, the first show, they said health and safety, said this is not going to work, it's too dangerous. So we had to put the lights up, and the show didn't work at all. Because the audience were just walking around nonchalantly, just treating it like a gallery, chatting, because there was no sense of threat.
Even though you'd told them not to talk.
Yeah, because here we have this huge swathe of darkness. If that's not there, then there's no mystery.
So how would you behave if you're thrust into an unfamiliar situation, given a set of off-putting rules, told to hide behind a mask? Sleep No More, for me, was a thrill. Unsettling on many dimensions, but also a thrill. What it really made me think about, however, wasn't Macbeth or Shakespeare or Hitchcock or all the awesomely grisly ideas promoted therein. I was mostly thinking about the audience. What it really made me think about was Philip Zimbardo, his Stanford prison experiment, and how people change their behavior depending on their surroundings. Here's Zimbardo again.
One of the things that strikes me about this interesting play is that it puts the audience in a totally new situation. That is, audience has never been asked to wear a mask, to have play a role, have set of rules to govern their behavior.
In a way, Sleep No More does to the audience every night what social scientists like Zimbardo have been doing in experiments for decades. They put people in a situation, fiddle with the variables, and see how they behave. Like Stanley Milgram's famous obedience experiments at Yale in the early 1960s, to see whether a volunteer would administer an electric jolt to someone if told to do so by an authority figure.
I know, I keep giving them shocks.
Continue, please.
I'm up to 390.
Continue, please.
After the Milgram experiments, Zimbardo got the idea to set up a fake prison at Stanford with some volunteers acting as guards and some as prisoners.
And that was the central commonality in the Milgram obedience studies and my Stanford prison study, is we put people in a totally new situation where, in both studies, we gave people total power over someone else.
The experiment was designed to go on for 2 weeks. 24 volunteers, all male college students, were randomly divided into inmates and guards. The inmates were arrested at their homes and brought to a makeshift prison in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department. Immediately, their individuality was taken away. The guards called them by ID number rather than name. They wore stocking caps to cover their hair and a short smock with no underwear. The guards, too, were dressed alike, essentially becoming anonymous. It didn't take long for the situation to curdle.
416, since you got your hands in the air, why don't you play Frankenstein?
This is correct.
293, you can be the bride of Frankenstein. You stand here. You come over there. You be the bride of Frankenstein, and you be Frankenstein. I want you to walk over here like Frankenstein and say that you love 293.
A third of the guards started to exploit their authority, taunting prisoners, making them simulate sodomy, clean toilets with their bare hands. Now, Zimbardo is a situationist.
I'm a situationist, dyed in the wool. Individual variations in, quote, personality predict almost nothing about people in these situations.
Meaning, he firmly believes that people aren't necessarily good or bad, but that their behavior is strongly dependent on their situation, on the role they're expected to play. During the Stanford prison experiment, the situation was so intense that after just 36 hours, some prisoners began to break down.
I mean, Jesus Christ, I'm burning up inside, don't you know? I can't stay in there. Up. I don't know how to explain it. I'm all f***ed up inside. Out, out! Out, out, now!
Instead of lasting 2 weeks, the experiment was canceled after 6 days.
The way the study ended was Christina Maslach, who had been my graduate student, who we had just started dating, comes down the night before and sees the guards abusing the prisoners. And I say, hey, Christina, look at that. Isn't that interesting? And she starts crying and runs out. And we have this big argument. And I'm saying, what kind of psychologist are you? This is a crucible of human nature. She says, wait a minute. She says, how could you see what I see and not see it as dehumanization? I thought I knew who you were. I don't know who you are. I don't know who this person is. And I'm not sure I want to continue my relationship with you if this is the real you.
How long had you been dating by this point?
Oh, probably 6 months.
And when she said it, was it kind of a light bulb moment for you, or did you fight against the impulse?
It was not a light bulb. It was a lightning bolt that when mm-hmm. she said it, we subsequently got married the next year because I realized she was my heroine who saved me because the study was going to go another full week. And I'm not sure what would have happened at that point. But it was a lightning bolt. And of course, I resisted at first because what it means is I had made this mistake. I should have ended it, you know, days earlier.
Yeah.
And essentially, yeah. It's what administrators do. I didn't do anything wrong, but I allowed wrongdoing to go on. And actually, one of the worst guards said in a later interview, the professor never said I couldn't do it, and therefore I did it.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, what lesson should we take away from the Stanford prison experiment? How about no lesson at all?
You know, I actually never... That's one result I don't believe.
So, does sleep no more offer a better lesson in human behavior?
I think you could come and just watch the audience for 3 hours, too.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, Hey, let me ask you this, Levitt. I'm sure you're familiar with the famous Stanford prison experiment, Philip Zimbardo, yes?
Sure.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. And over the course of his academic career, he has run and observed a lot of experiments, both in the lab and in the field.
That's one result I don't believe. I just fundamentally don't believe that if you take undergrads and you put them into the role of the prisoner versus the prison guard, it's just, you know, I've never tried it, but I just don't believe that it's real. And I think to get it, you have to manipulate other things. It just doesn't seem right to me that people are like that. Now, maybe that's what's so amazing about it is that it really happens. And there was, I mean, I don't know if you were with me by the time I was talking to a director from the BBC, and he said that he had tried to recreate that for the BBC, and it got so ugly so quickly that he had to cancel the whole thing, and they didn't even do the show. But I don't know.
But wait, got so ugly so quickly, connoting that it did happen, yes?
Yeah, he said it was real too, but yeah. You know, a lot of times what I've found is that when I try to do experiments as an economist that work great for psychologists,
right,
I cannot get them to work. And I really have come to believe that it's because the people in the study are so keen on doing what the researcher wants them to do, and they think that the psychologist wants him to behave in one way, and they think the economist wants him to behave in a different way. And so it's hard to reproduce some of those psychological findings. So I would love to do the prison study, and I'd love to do it in a way that was unbiased. And I just that's one thing. I would bet a lot of money that that things wouldn't turn out the way they did in that old Zimbardo study.
Well, you know, let me read you. Here's what a couple of the volunteers who played guards back then, 40-some years ago, here's what they said recently. One said that he was playing a role from the outset, trying to create drama to, quote, give the researchers something to work with. And another guard said, I didn't think it was ever meant to go the full 2 weeks. I think Zimbardo wanted to create a dramatic crescendo and then end it as quickly as possible. I felt that throughout the experiment, he knew what he wanted and then tried to shape the experiment by how it was constructed and how it played out to fit the conclusion that he had already worked out. He wanted to be able to say that college students, people from middle class backgrounds, that people will turn on each other just because they're given a role and given power.
So people won't believe me. I've never heard those quotes. I didn't know anyone else thought that way. What I said before was just my intuition that that is not human behavior, what got revealed in those studies.
A study like the Stanford prison experiment could never happen today, at least not in the U.S. When it was over, the American Psychological Association imposed new standards for how research subjects could be treated. So if you really want to mess with someone, manipulate their mind, your best bet may still be the theater. That's one of the pleasures of seeing Sleep No More, watching your fellow audience members get lost in the work. They don their masks and cast off their social mores. Yes, a few of them act out. They interfere with the cast. They steal.
They steal.
Yeah? What do they steal?
They love the letters in Malcolm's office, Lady Macbeth's letters. They love to wear Lady Macduff's fur coat. They love the nurse's jacket. They love Macbeth's coat that he gets hung in.
They have sex.
I think every show we've done,
there's been some sex.
Yep.
And there is empathy, too. During Sleep No More, one character tries to poison Lady Macduff. Here's Maxine Doyle, the show's choreographer and co-director.
There have been moments when audience have tried to interrupt that moment. There's been moments when Lady Macduff, we set this up, she falls in the party. Sometimes they let her fall on the floor. Most of the time, somebody will save her. More interestingly is Lady Macbeth, decline of her story plays out in the hospital, and she finishes in an image which is really vulnerable, and she's naked and bloody in another bathtub in the hospital, and she beckons to the audience sometimes to help, and some audience will pick up a towel and will give her a towel or will hold her, So it tends to be that audiences want to save, nurture, protect.
And here again is Tori Sparks, who plays Lady Macbeth, and Nick Bruder, who used to play Macbeth.
Some people's actions are just, they can be sincere too, or yeah. they offer one of the Macbeths a towel while they're in the bathtub washing off the blood. And the most sincere gesture possible.
Is it moving?
Yeah. It really can be. With the intent behind anything can really move you. It just depends on why they're doing
it. That's a good point. It's the intent behind things.
Yeah. Everybody. Well,
there's 20 characters.
Yeah.
So I could have a really great night.
Right. And somebody else has a crap night.
Do you guys then have a post-mortem afterwards?
When we all collect in the elevator at the end, it is they're just unreeling the nights. Did you see this person in that dress? Did you see that guy in that polka dot shirt? Can you believe what he did? He took this, he took that. You know, everybody's just like unleashing it all.
Great night. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
In the end, Sleep No More is too woolly, too freewheeling, to think of as a social experiment. But it does look a little bit like society itself. Rules are established and sometimes broken. Mores are adopted, but not by everyone. What's most interesting, most encouraging perhaps, is how in Sleep No More, as in society in general, what we don't end up with is total chaos. Here's Steve Levitt again.
When I teach my class on the economics of crime to the undergraduates at the U of C, one of the points I stress over and over is that the puzzle is not why is there so much crime. The puzzle is just the opposite. Why is there so little crime? Why does the average person who has literally hundreds of chances to commit crimes in a day not take advantage of those, right? Every time you walk past a five-year-old, on the street, on the playground, you know, you could bonk them over the head with no repercussions, you know, and run off. Or you could steal candy. You could take...
It's a real high-stakes crime you're talking about, beating up children stealing candy.
But nobody does them. And you don't worry about people doing them. And even when there are, I mean, I'll be in a big room lecturing and I'll leave my cell phone and my backpack that has my computer in it. If I lost a computer, I would be beside myself. But I'll have complete faith that no one is going to steal it. And it's really not ultimately because they think they'll be caught. I think that one of the greatest powers of society is the ability to inculcate in people a sense of right and wrong. And so the overwhelming majority of people are trained to not do things that are negative to other people. I mean, even criminals, I think, have some honor. It's rare for a criminal to, you know, beat up an 80-year-old lady. You know, it happens from time to time, but criminals show some judgment in that regard.
So the next time you're at the grocery store or in church or in an elevator, ask yourself, am I behaving the way I am because of who I am or simply because of my surroundings? What would I do if I were wearing a mask? Am I as much of an individual as I think I am, or am I more like a lump of silly putty just waiting for society or a theater director to mold me?
I think it makes you a little more daring, a little less inhibited.
More mischievous?
You got really gutsy by the end.
I was really going for it.
Brusquely pushing people aside to follow the person I was trying to follow.
I got a little rude.
I would try to like make noises at other people.
I mean, I think you just, there's no boundaries.
No, it's completely different than anything I've ever experienced. It just felt good. It was right in the moment.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.